Mr. Adelman.
Please the court, counsel. Defendant made a false statement in a collection letter which it sent to Mary Lou Hahn. In its March 1, 2006 letter, it states that the amount due is $1,051.91, that the interest due is $8,264, that the total due is $1,134.55, and it explains that the $1,134.55 is, quote, inclusive of interest accrued in accordance with the terms of your original agreement, close quote. So they explain what they mean by interest. In fact, the $8,264 is not the correct amount of interest. Discovery has shown that nearly half of the entire amount was interest, and that the defendant has admitted that they only put in the interest due the interest added subsequent to their purchase of the debt. So that the explanation, this interest is accrued in accordance with the terms of the original agreement, admittedly applies only to the total due and not to the interest which figure which is given on the line immediately above. This usage of interest due is not true. It is not consistent with ordinary English. It's not consistent with the standard among other debt collectors. And it gives them an unfair advantage over those debt collectors who comply with the industry standard. The industry standard...
Mr. Adelman, about where the falsity is.
The falsity...
The line item interest due, you agree it's all interest.
That is correct.
You seem to be treating the line amount due as if it said principal due, but it doesn't. It just says an amount. And amounts can include, well, anything. So I can't see where the falsity is.
Because if the interest due is stated to be $8,264 and the interest due in the debt is in fact over $500, I think that the statement interest due is false. It gives a mathematical description.
Interest due as if it said all the interest due. But that's not what it says.
I think when the explanation is furnished, accrued in accordance with the terms of your original agreement, I think that is what it says. I do not think that it is appropriate for the defendant to use in a collection letter an explanation of interest and then say it only applies to the third line and not the second line when the first line and the second line equal the third line. There is, in fact, an industry standard as to what should be done in this case. It arose from the lawsuit that the Debt Buyers Association brought against the IRS commissioner. The IRS has a reporting requirement. If a debt is settled, and this letter does propose a settlement, and more than $600 is written off in principal, the owner of the debt must report either the principal or the total amount with the interest broken out so that by virtue of subtraction, you can determine the amount to explain on your tax return. The Debt Buyers Association thought this was onerous for the collection industry to have to comply with. District of Columbia District Court said, no, you're in the shoes of the original creditor. The creditor has this information. If for some reason you can't get it, compute it under the contract. In other words, in accordance with the terms of the original agreement.
Is that because of the whether interest might be deductible or something and it gets into a tax formula?
What has to be reported to the IRS and explained on your return is the principal. That's what they want. If you were to
the principal of what?
The underlying debt. In other words, in this context,
for,
the purchases
for showing
and cash
a loss?
Advances. For showing potential income due to the discharge of indebtedness, for example, in a settlement. This letter does, in fact, propose a settlement. If one were to take this letter at face value, they're offering a settlement that is substantially less than the principal owed. In fact, it is not substantially less than the principal owed, and they get an advantage over those debt collectors who conform to the industry standard. So that I think there is an unfair competition aspect of this as well. Finally, I think the letter is inconsistent on its face when it says
unfair competition have to do with the Fair Debt Collection
Practices
Act. If this were a suit by a rival collection agency, I could see an unfair competition claim, although it does seem particularly weak. But what does it have to do with this statute?
One of the stated purposes in 1692 is the protection of debt collectors that comply with the law from those that do not.
If a debt collector has a claim, the debt collector can bring it. But it's a pretty fundamental principle that A can't sue on an injury done to B.
Unless Congress creates a right to recover statutory damages for that.
The Constitution, Congress can entitle A to sue on an injury done to B.
In this case,
controversy requirement.
In this case, Hahn and the other class members did receive the offending letter, and I do think they have, under the statute, the right to sue. Triumph could very readily have avoided the problem. If it wanted to call the interest due the interest that we have added, it could do so. If it wanted to say nothing about the composition of the debt, it could do so. However, if it elected to state for either negotiation purposes or because it has to ultimately provide this information for tax purposes, what the debt consists of, it has to give an interest figure which is consistent with that which would be given by the creditor. It didn't.
When Triumph purchased the debt, I guess isn't that how that worked?
Yes.
Yeah. They obviously purchased it for a whole lot less than the amount due.
That is correct.
Yeah. So that in itself changes the complexion if you look at it from that point of view. The debt they acquired. It's. I know we're faced with this. You know, this one of those things that's going to go into the bad bank or whatever it is that's going on at the national level. Is this one of those troubled assets that is going to be devalued and then maybe somebody's going to collect on them?
I don't know, but in response to your question, Your Honor, they probably paid $20 to $50 for this.
Not much, yeah.
That is correct.
But they're on its base. That's the accumulation of the debt at that point, and now they're showing the interest, and I assume assessed at the same, whatever's in the original note, the interest on this 1051.91 is probably the same rate of interest that was in the original note.
I actually do not believe it is.
You don't think that's right, the 82.64?
I believe that it's not clear from the record, but I believe it's simply the statutory 5% in Illinois.
That would it?
However, I don't think the district court relied on Barnes for the proposition that you can look at this from the standpoint of the debt collector. But Barnes went out of its way to emphasize that there was no false statement or misleading statement to the debtor. And in this case, I submit that the statement interest due with a number on it other than the interest on the account, particularly when coupled with the explanation that is given that we are accruing interest in accordance with the underlying contract, is a false statement. The defendant also says, well, you can look at the underlying credit card statements, in this case, three-year-old credit card statements. But under this court's Fields decision, that's not an appropriate defense. Fields says that even an eight-month-old invoice is not an appropriate justification for a false statement in a collection letter. For example, it is the justification assumes that the same person is dealing with a collection letter as paid the original account. In this case, Ms. Hahn's husband paid her bills. He died. That's why the debt was in default. And 3 years later, Ms. Hahn cannot be expected to know that which her husband knew. It also assumes that the debtor has kept the statements. Conventional wisdom is to destroy them so as to avoid identity theft, or that you're going to remember what they contained, which is also not a fair assumption. So I submit that we do have a false statement.
What exactly in the letter misstates the fact?
The false statement is interest due 8264, and I think that is compounded by the explanation inclusive of interest accrued in accordance with the terms of the original agreement.
But doesn't it say, the letter say, the balance outstanding as of today's date is $11,34.55?
That is correct. But I think that when you say that, and then you have one item and only one other item that identifies interest, that you cannot use the terms differently. There's a principle of construction. Terms in the document are presumed to be used in a consistent manner. I don't think it's merely a legal construct. It explains how people actually think. And if a statement that the interest due is 8264 and an explanation of how it is computed is, I think, a referent to the interest figure that is given. Unless Your Honors have some other questions, I have no other comments.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Edelman. Mr. Messer.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Counsel. Simply put, there's no law in existence for the proposition that a debt collector cannot use the term interest due in a collection letter to describe the interest that's accrued on that debt collector's watch. In fact, the Barnes decision addresses this situation. And it says in the Barnes decision, that's this Court's 2007 decision, that the amount due the debtor must be the amount owed to the debt collector, not the original creditor. This Court would have to overturn its decision in the Barnes case in order to rule for the plaintiff in this case. Importantly, Judge Flom, I think, pointed out...
Edelman would not be averse to that outcome.
Judge Flom, I think, hit it right on the head when he looked at the collection letter, which is page appendix number 6 to plaintiff's opening brief. It says, amount due, $1,051.91. That's one line item. The other says, interest due, $82.64. That was the interest that's accrued on our client's watch. And then the line in the letter says, the balance outstanding as of today's date is $1,134.55, inclusive of interest accrued in accordance with the terms of your original agreement. So you can look at that number and look at the total due and know that the total due includes the interest accrued under the original agreement. There's no confusion. There's nothing about that situation that makes it unclear that the $1,134.55, that total balance due, includes interest that accrued prior to our clients having this debt. The appellant's theory would generate confusion among consumers because it would force debt collectors to either not inform debtors of the interest that accrued during their tenure and instead use collection letters with unexplained increasing amounts due, or it would require collectors to add multiple and perplexing categories of interest and finance charges to show the interest due that was before their tenure and during their tenure. And that's not what the FDCPA is looking for. The FDCPA wants clarity. They don't want additional confusion, things that trip up the consumers and make it hard to understand a collection letter. What this collection letter is...
Hell, have you bought a house recently? There's a federal statute requiring supposedly clear disclosures for closing on a house, and the forms are more than 50 pages long.
I know that. And fortunately...
When the federal government says we want clarity, they may not mean what normal people mean by clarity.
But this court's been the beacon of light in the FDCPA. This court's the court that has issued the Barnes decision and said this is how you do it, and you don't need to break out interest showing what the original creditor. You need to look at it from the perspective of the collector and not the original creditor. And that's why Barnes controls... And that's why this court could stop at Barnes alone and not go any further and rule in favor of the defendants here. And in fact, the Barnes decision has been repeatedly followed by district courts throughout the Seventh Circuit.
So.
Excuse me?
I certainly hope so, but why does that help us understand what Barnes means?
Well, it sheds light, I think, on Barnes because it shows how the district courts have interpreted Barnes. And in fact, you know, it shows that the direction is very clear to the district courts, and to the extent that Barnes were meddled with, it's going to really, muck up the situation. You've got the Wall v. Midland Credit case, where the plaintiff said that statements regarding principal due and accrued interest were false. The court there said that the amount of the debt that must be correctly stated under Section 1692E is the amount of the debt being sought by the debt collector, not the amount owed to the underlying creditor. Humes v. Blatt Hassenmiller. The plaintiff argued that the defendant's itemization of principal and interest sought in the collection lawsuit rather than the underlying debt was false. Court said it's not the entire amount of the underlying debt, but instead the amount of the debt that's owed to the debt collector. You've got Smith v. First National Credit Bureau, Collection Bureau, almost identical facts to this case, and the court cited Barnes to rule in the defendant's favor. So Barnes, you know, disrupting Barnes would really muddy the pellucid waters, and it would remove a beacon of light and clarity to, in this area. Importantly, the plaintiff was not confused. The record demonstrates that the plaintiff was never confused by this collection letter. She knew the amount due in the collection letter included interest. There's testimony to that effect. She admitted receiving credit card statements, and she admitted that she could have reviewed them at any time to determine what the amounts of interest and principal and other charges were. Now, again, Barnes would have done it, but you can also look, in this case, the district court focused on the fact that plaintiff had never given any extrinsic evidence of any consumer confusion in ruling against the defendant. That's established Seventh Circuit precedent, that in the case where there's multiple meanings, multiple potential interpretations of a collection letter, which is exactly what plaintiff advocates here when they say if it's reasonable to infer that interest due can either refer to total interest or only the interest added by the debt collector, the statement is patently ambiguous. That's the plaintiff's own word, the statement is patently ambiguous. That in that case, the Seventh Circuit, in a series of cases, has said that extrinsic evidence is necessary to demonstrate that a significant fraction of the population would have been confused or misled by the interest by the statement, here the interest due statement, that began back more than 10 years ago in the Avila v. Rubin case, continued with the Johnson v. Revenue case, the Pettit v. Retrieval Masters case, the Durkin v. Equifax case, and most recently the Every v. RJM case. Plaintiff has an obligation to bring forth extrinsic evidence of this consumer confusion when there's multiple meanings of a collection letter, and that was not done in this case. And that is a situation that you just can't get around. The case law is crystal clear. The so-called authorities cited by plaintiff here that he alleges create some kind of an industry standard, they're completely irrelevant to the situation. He cites the Debt Buyer v. Snow case, these Treasury regulations, and an ACA international publication that's not even in the record. These documents have to do with how debt buyers report discharged interest to the IRS when they're filing 1099-C forms. It doesn't have anything to do with collection letters and the FDCPA. It has to do with the IRS regulations and how you deal with that situation. It creates no standard whatsoever with respect to how debt collectors use language in their collection letters. It's a red herring. In fact, the fact that they're being cited shows the futility of the argument. The cases cited for the proposition that an unsophisticated consumer doesn't apply are meaningless as well. You've got the Gearing case. In that situation, there was no potential multiple interpretations. In Gearing, you had a situation where the collector falsely described the collector's legal relationship with the creditor. It's a black and white situation. Similarly, Randolph v. IMBS, it was a false statement that a debt that had been discharged in bankruptcy was still owed. It's a black and white situation. Importantly, the Wilbur v. Fields v. Wilbur case, that case did not have to do with interest. In fact, it only had to do with attorney's fees, and the court specifically mentioned that the account had accrued interest but did not include interest as one of the impermissible add-ons. So that adds no value. Similarly, the Bull v. Asset Acceptance case had to do with attorney's fees, and Ransom and Ramondi had to do with service charges, threatening criminal sanctions or threatening to call the debtor's employer. Again, nothing to do with interest or how it's characterized in a collection letter. Finally, the plaintiff has asked this court to find Triumph Partnerships to be a debt collector. That's an issue that was never raised in the lower court. In fact, federal appellate courts don't consider, as Your Honors I'm sure know, don't consider issues not decided by the district courts except for in rare circumstances, and that would be where a proper resolution is beyond a doubt or where injustice would otherwise result. Those statements or allegations have never been made. Triumph Partnership doesn't, even if it were to be considered Triumph Partnership, it is no way near a collector under the FDCPA. It doesn't use any of the instrumentalities of interstate commerce to collect. It's under the definition a creditor to one whom a debt is owed. It didn't draft, authorize, or send or do anything with the collection.
The means and instrumentalities of interstate commerce.
That's the language from the statute.
Sends no mail, makes no phone calls.
Not to debtors. Not to debtors. It uses Allied. It has a collection agency agreement with Allied, and it engages Allied to do that work. And, in fact, doesn't get involved with it. It doesn't determine what the contents of the collection letters are. It doesn't control the collection process. There's nothing that Allied does in that connection that would enmesh it in that process. Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement.